Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open with coverage of supervisors' historic decision Tuesday to repeal what Native American tribes have long viewed as a racist law that had blocked local tribes from buying back their own ancestral lands. Next, hear about a new TV station that the City of Santee is creating to bring you coverage of everything from city council meetings to community concerts. Rolling to Remember, an annual Memorial Day weekend motorcycle ride in our nation's capital to honor fallen and missing service members, has hit a roadblock for this year's event, and we'll have details on what Congressman Issa is doing to change that. Mosquito season is here. Learn what you need to know to fight the bite and protect yourself against invasive mosquito species that can carry diseases such as Zika, dengue fever, West Nile virus, and more. California's gubernatorial recall election is taking on a circus atmosphere, including one candidate, Republican John Cox, who is drawing criticism for taking a live bear on the campaign trail. New relief funds for restaurants, breweries, wineries, and other food and beverage businesses are here. Find out how to apply for this relief that was co-sponsored by local Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs on today's show. Then on Sounds of History, hear about some historic sights to see in Lemon Grove in honor of National Historic Preservation Week. On Crime Beat, learn about an illegal dispensary in Spring Valley caught selling counterfeit candy and chips that mimic major brand names but are laced with marijuana and being marketed to children. From California News Service, hear about a proposal for cutting health care costs in California. A local family of five lost their home in the Southern Fire. Hear how you can help them on today's show. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news headlines today, including a crackdown on extremists in the military and an update on troop withdrawals in Afghanistan. Now, if you're looking for a convenient place to get the COVID-19 vaccine, we have good news. The county has now opened up walk-in and evening clinics, and we'll have details. Lions, Tigers, and Bears in Alpine has rescued a white tiger and other exotic cats. And finally, today, we'll be re-airing our interview with author Mike Sirota on his novel, Freedom's Hand, and more. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is the East County Magazine Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Miriam Raftery with a Tribal Beat report. By a 4-1 vote, San Diego County's Board of Supervisors voted Wednesday to make it easier for local Native American tribes to expand their reservations. The board voted to repeal a resolution passed by supervisors back in 1994, which required the county to oppose all tribal requests to add land to their reservations under the federal fee-to-trust process. That process allowed tribes to buy back ancestral lands, but San Diego has long blocked this from happening. San Diego County is home to 19 Native American reservations and 18 tribal governments, more than any other county in the U.S. Representatives from five of those tribes gave impassioned testimony at Wednesday's virtual hearing, all urging supervisors to repeal the measure. Marcos Cuero, chairman of the Campo Band of Kumeyaay Indians, told supervisors,
"The Campo Reservation is located 50 miles east of San Diego, but that is not always the case. All of what is now called San Diego County, the area which you govern, is Native American land. Our lands are where each of you sit today. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, the federal government set aside lands for many tribal communities to survive and retain their culture. However, after the reservations were created, the government created ways to take away those lands from tribes and put them into private ownership through the General Allotment Act and other policies. After our reservations were created, Indian lands were diminished from 138 million acres to 48 million acres. These policies shredded many of our reservations from removing portions of our land and leaving private inholdings in others. In 1934, the Indian Reorganization Act was passed to create a method to right these wrongs. Among its provisions is a fee-to-trust process that allows federally recognized tribes to regain some of the lands lost and place them back into sovereign control. The tribal governments must buy back these lands. They are not given to them. And the BIA has created regulations to ensure that this process of transferring them into tribal control is fair and transparent. In 1994, when the Board of Supervisors approved a resolution to oppose all fee-to-trust applications by tribal governments in San Diego County for any and no reason, it was actually stating that the federal law that allows tribes to regain their former lands does not apply in San Diego County. It was stating that the Board of Supervisors would do all in its power to deny that the tribes in San Diego County would receive the benefit of that federal law. It was an aggressive anti-tribal action which sought to hinder tribal self-governance and costly the tribes. I hope that you remove this impediment and start down a new path with our Native people. Thank you.
The next to speak was Erica Pinto, chairwoman of the Hamul Indian Village.
I really appreciate the new direction that this County Board of Supervisors is heading. My tribe specifically, Hamul, has had the worst experience with the past Board of Supervisors, and it prevented us from expanding our land base for homes, for medical buildings, for cultural centers. This new path that the County Board of Supervisors is proposing to take with the rescinding of the policy is a long time coming. As humans, we evolved. The first governor of California had a bounty on American Indian heads and paid the price to murder our people. That's changed. The governor Newsom has since apologized for the atrocities towards Native Americans. We evolved. We changed policies. We rescind policies. We remove statues. We don't name buildings in honor of people who have contributed to such atrocities. So my request for the County Board of Supervisors is to please consider rescinding this, vote to rescind this policy.
Michael Garcia, vice chair of the WIAPI, noted that his tribe has a small reservation in Alpine and a larger one on Mount Laguna. One of the reservations has a health clinic that serves seven tribes. One reservation, known as Big WIAPI, is so remote at an elevation of over 5,600 feet that it's off the San Diego Gas and Electric Company grid and has a single unsafe access road. Vice Chair Garcia then said,
between 2001 and 2002, WIAPI engaged the county in negotiation of a draft cooperative agreement. However, at the instructions of the board, the CAO terminated the negotiation with the tribe by letter dated November 27, 2002, and directed its staff not to open or continue any future discussions with the tribe. The county has opposed the WIAPI band's two non-gaming feeder trust applications four times, their submission in 2001, and appealed BIA approvals of our non-gaming feeder trust application four times to the Interior Board of the Indian Appeals. This opposition by the county to non-gaming feeder trust applications by an off-grid tribe should be an embarrassment to the county and not a board policy. These resolutions are inequitable. They result in harm to both tribal community interests or tribal county interests, and they disqualify the county as a good faith party in any negotiation of interest.
Bo Mazzetti, chairman of the Rincon Band of Luseño Indians, made an impassioned plea for supervisors to do the right thing, in his words.
You know, you don't know what you've lost till you lost it. Generation after generation, our people been handed down where our land's at and what we lost. It's been 170 years since our land was taken, and the fact that some of us, I want to make that clear, some tribes, very few of us, have the economic base to buy back our own land. And that's what we're asking, is just a fair opportunity to buy back our own land.
And then Chairman Mazzetti said pointedly,
it's time to get rid of this outright racist law. And that's exactly what it is. A racist law against the Indian people in this county. And I thank you for your time. Definitely, it's time to change this. Let's do what's right. Thank you.
Robert Smith, chairman of the Pala Band of Mission Indians, also urged support for the action in a brief statement. Later, in a press release issued after the decision, he stated that tribes have employed thousands of local residents with good-paying jobs and make significant contributions to San Diego's economy. According to county staff, That's true. The Indian gaming industry alone has created over 10,000 jobs in the San Diego region, resulting in a $1 billion industry. And the tribes have also generously donated to support many local charities as well as local firefighting efforts. The measure to repeal the blanket obstruction of tribal expansion of their lands was introduced by Supervisors Jim Desmond and Nora Vargas. Supervisor Desmond defined the need this way during the hearing.
New board, you know, fairness and equity and equitably treatment of each other is, you know, is really come to, you know, to the focus. And I want to make sure that we're doing that with the tribes as well. You know, simply put, what this does is it adopts a resolution that takes away a longstanding blanket no for any and every application for the tribes to take land into trust.
The measure requires that any future fee-to-trust proposal be evaluated on the merits of each case. The county must consider economic benefits to the county in weighing future projects as well. And the new law eases restrictions on tribes obtaining liquor licenses. Supervisor Desmond said of the strict alcohol limits imposed by prior supervisors that he felt it's quite unfair, adding, "We don't do this with any other jurisdiction or entity. Tribes will now be subject to the same rules governing any other entity applying for liquor sales." In addition, the measure passed Wednesday will establish a tribal liaison position to further the government-to-government relationship between the county and each of the 18 local tribal governments. The measure passed 4-1, with East County Supervisor Joel Anderson voting no, despite having numerous Native American reservations in his district. Supervisor Anderson did not state a reason for his opposition in the hearing, and his office has not responded to our inquiry as of show taping deadline. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Grab your popcorn and get ready. Santee is creating its own television station to provide viewers with around-the-clock content on all things Santee. In addition to televising public meetings such as city council, committees, and commission hearings, the channel will also broadcast events such as the Summer Concert Series, programs about the city's history, and how-to programs such as navigating the permit process. The TV station will also have interactive games, says Bree Humphrey, the city's marketing coordinator and manager of the new TV station. The city also announced the return of its popular summer concert series, starting June 24th at Town Center Community Park. Other concert dates are July 15th, July 22nd, August 5th, and August 12th. The city also plans to hold a dual fireworks event, Santee Salutes, on July 4th, as was done in December to celebrate the city's 40th anniversary amid the pandemic. Santee TV also plans to partner with other agencies, such as the Padre Dam Water District and the Santee Unified School District, to generate additional programming, with content airing 24/7. The city has allocated $57,000 so far to fund startup costs for its new TV station. Santee will tap into franchise fees it collects from telecommunications services that do business in the city to pay for the station long term. In the current fiscal year that ends June 30th, the city will collect about $3 million in such fees, according to the city's budget. The bulk of these franchise fees come from the city's contract with Waste Management, the city's trash hauler that was granted a 10-year extension in August. Viewers will be able to access Santee TV on Cox Channel 117 or at AT&T Channel 99 when it launches in early June. For those who don't get or cannot afford cable, Santee TV will also be available on the city's website via a streaming software, Humphrey said. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Alexa Oslowski.
California gubernatorial recalls have long been likened to circuses, and now Republican candidate John Cox from San Diego's North County has added to that circus-like atmosphere by hauling a Kodiak brown bear along on his campaign trail, drawing criticisms from animal rights advocates. Cox chose the bear as a symbol because he says he's positioning himself as a beast, seeking to replace Governor Gavin Newsom, whom he characterizes as a beauty. He touts a need for big beastly changes, including slashing taxes. The animal rights group PETA, however, posted a tweet calling it shameful for Cox to exploit a bear for publicity. PETA adds, "Wild animals must be left alone, not confined to a pen and wheeled out for events. They're not props." State Senator Ben Wesso, a San Diego Democrat, authored Senate Bill 313, which became law in 2019 and banned the use of wild or exotic animals in circuses. Senator Wesso slammed Cox's action as a publicity stunt, adding, "I was disappointed and appalled to see gubernatorial hopeful John Cox parade a live bear to his press conference in Sacramento." The San Francisco Chronicle reports that Cox has bemoaned media coverage of his events as all about the bear, not surprisingly. Despite the criticisms, he plans to continue a 6-city bus tour with the bear, City News Service reports. Other candidates running for Newsom's seat, if the recall succeeds, include former San Diego Mayor Kevin Faulkner and transgender former Olympic athlete Caitlyn Jenner. So far, no prominent Democrat has thrown their hat into the ring, and all are backing Newsom. Newsom has slammed the recall effort as a waste of time and taxpayer dollars, noting that he is slated to run for re-election next year. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Many veterans from San Diego County have long participated in an annual Memorial Day weekend motorcycle ride in Washington, D.C. to honor fallen comrades and remember those who went missing during wartime. But now veterans groups and members of Congress are criticizing the Department of Defense for denying a permit request for riders to use the Pentagon parking lot as a staging area for the annual Rolling to Remember motorcycle ride. The ride, organized by AMVETS, a veterans organization, honors fallen American soldiers, prisoners of war, and those missing in action, as well as calling attention to the crisis of veteran suicides. Multiple other federal agencies, including the Department of Interior and Department of Transportation, approved the ride along the Capitol Mall slated for May 30th. But despite an application that AMVETS says it submitted last July, the Department of Defense on Friday denied the request. The Defense Department cited the pandemic as the reason, the New York Post reports. A Pentagon statement indicates that if COVID-19 conditions improve, the department would consider supporting a future event request from AMVETS, potentially as soon as Labor Day weekend. But for thousands of veterans already planning to converge on Washington, D.C. over the Memorial Day weekend, the news comes as a major disappointment. However, the event may still be held. AMVETS National Director Joe Schinelli told Fox News that the group is looking into alternative staging areas in hopes of still holding the ride, perhaps staging near RFK Stadium. The Stars and Stripes reports that AMVETS leaders have said they are confident they could hold a safe, reasonable demonstration outdoors that incorporates social distancing, masking where appropriate, and sanitation stations. The Rolling to Remember ride went virtual in 2020 during the Trump administration due to the pandemic, but participants have been looking forward to resuming the event live this year. In 2019, the Rolling to Remember ride replaced an earlier annual ride in the nation's capital called Rolling Thunder, which was held for 32 years. San Diego's Republican Congressman Daryl Issa sent a letter to the Department of Defense in April urging approval of the permit for the ride. Issa issued a statement calling it a terrible mistake for the Defense Department to block the veterans' charity from using the Pentagon parking lot for the Rolling to Remember ride. Issa says, "This last-minute rejection, a first of its kind in more than 30 years, leaves patriotic veterans without a safe alternative." He notes that days earlier, President Biden hosted a drive-in rally in Georgia. Issa says, "The Rolling to Remember event is no less safe." Other demonstrations have been held in recent months in Washington, D.C., including racial justice protests and now the infamous rally held by President Trump and his supporters, which ended in an unpermitted march to the Capitol and subsequent insurrection. The annual ride to honor veterans has been a long-standing tradition in both Republican and Democratic administrations, one that many veterans and families of fallen or missing soldiers hope will continue under the Biden administration. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Angela Kurish.
This is Mitchell Murphy with the Health Report. With temperatures rising and summer coming, the county's vector control program has held its first aerial larvicide drop this week on dozens of local waterways to help stop mosquitoes from spreading diseases like the West Nile virus. Vector control officials are reminding people to protect themselves from mosquito-borne illnesses by dumping out standing water in and around their homes to keep mosquitoes from breeding. The county has used helicopters to drop batches of solid, granular larvicide on 30-plus hard-to-reach rivers, streams, ponds, and other waterways roughly once a month from April or May through October since West Nile virus arrived here in the early 2000s. According to the county, the larvicide does not hurt people or pets, but it kills mosquito larvae before they can grow into biting mosquitoes. The virus's effect has been mild in San Diego County in recent years, with just one person testing positive in 2020 and three in 2019. All contracted the virus outside the county, and none died. But West Nile virus remains a potentially dangerous disease. 22 county residents tested positive for it in 2016, and two people died. Last year, across California, 258 people tested positive, and 11 died. West Nile virus is mainly a bird disease, but it can be transmitted to people and animals, like horses, by mosquitoes that feed on infected birds and then bite a person or an animal. Protecting against mosquitoes has required more help from the public in recent years because of the appearance of several invasive Aedes mosquitoes that can potentially transmit diseases not naturally found here, including Zika, dengue, and chikungunya. While native Culex mosquitoes that can transmit West Nile virus breed in larger bodies of water reached by the county's larvicide drops, invasive Aedes mosquitoes live and breed around homes and yards. County vector control officials say the best way people can protect themselves from mosquitoes is to follow their Prevent, Protect, Report guidelines. County residents may be more vulnerable to being bitten by mosquitoes around their homes now because many have been spending more time at home because of the COVID-19 pandemic. To prevent mosquitoes from breeding, dump out or remove items inside and outside homes that could hold water, such as plant saucers, rain gutters, buckets, garbage cans, toys, old tires, and wheelbarrows. Mosquito fish are now available from the Vector Control Program. The fish can control mosquito breeding in stagnant swimming pools, ponds, fountains, and horse troughs. Protect yourself from mosquito-borne illnesses by wearing long sleeves and pants or use insect repellent when outdoors. Be sure repellent contains DEET, Bicaridin, oil of lemon at eucalyptus, or IR3535. Keep screens on windows and doors in good condition and secured to keep insects out. Residents are asked to report increased mosquito activity, as well as stagnant, green swimming pools, and other mosquito breeding sources. Also report dead birds, especially dead crows, ravens, jays, hawks, and owls. In addition, the county asks residents to report if you are bitten by mosquitoes during daylight hours, or if you find mosquitoes that look like the invasive Aedes mosquitoes, which are small and black with white stripes on legs and backs. To file a report, you can call 858-694-2888 or email vector@sdcounty.ca.gov.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The American Rescue Plan signed into law by President Joe Biden includes a restaurant revitalization fund to help food and beverage industry businesses offset losses from the COVID-19 pandemic. Owners can apply now for the Restaurant Revitalization Fund through the U.S. Small Business Administration at restaurants.sba.gov. Again, that address is restaurants.sba.gov. The fund is open not only to restaurants, but also caterers, bars, bakeries, wineries, breweries, distillery food carts, inns, and certain other businesses where food sales provided a major source of revenues. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, who championed the bill in Congress, says small businesses are the backbone of our community and our economy, adding that they deserve more help to make it through this pandemic. She adds that she is proud to fight to help small business owners and support the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, which will help keep businesses open, workers on payroll, and our economy back on track. The Restaurant Revitalization Fund will provide restaurants and other eligible businesses with funding equal to their pandemic-related revenue loss up to $10 million per business. The relief does not have to be repaid, provided that the funds are put toward eligible uses by March of next year. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Angela Kurish.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show. And now, it's time for the Sounds of History.
This is Jonathan Goetz bringing you the Sounds of History. May is National Preservation Month, and the Lemon Grove Historical Society invites you to take a stroll around town to visit five of Lemon Grove's beloved historic structures. The Parsonage Museum on Olive Street is open Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Built in 1897 as the First Congregational Church of Lemon Grove, this Redwood Folk Victorian was created by volunteer ranchers under the guidance of Reverend Isaac Atherton for $912. A second structure was later added in 1911 when it became a parsonage to house the pastor, when the structure was moved to its present location to make way for a larger church. The steeple was removed about 1915. In 1994, the city bought the property and the Historical Society, led by Helen Ofield, restored the decaying church. It became the Parsonage Museum, winning the Governor's Historic Preservation Award in 2001. A second historic site is the Big Lemon at Main and Broadway. This beloved monument of civic folk art is made of plaster, timber, and chicken wire. The giant lemon was built by volunteer ranchers and made its first appearance as a parade float on July 4, 1928 in San Diego, carrying the first Miss Lemon Grove and her six princesses. The Big Lemon served as an annual float until 1932, when it was placed on Main Street, where it has become an iconic symbol of Lemon Grove. Another historic site is the Grove Pastry Shop. Built by Dr. Charles Good, a local citrus grower and dentist, this Mission Revival building stands at Main and Pacific, the site of the town's original general store that burned down in 1906. A temporary store was built, and the structure has since been used as a market, an auto parts store, and a waterbed store before Grove Pastry Shop opened there in 1980, operating until 2016. On the side of the Grove Pastry Shop building, you can see the Lemon Grove History Mural, a must-see attraction depicting Lemon Grove from its first Native American residents through pioneer times to the present day. St. Philip the Apostle Church, a Gothic-style structure built in 1887, may be the most traveled church in the country. It was built in downtown San Diego, later moved near San Diego State University, and relocated again in 1970 to its present location on Hardy Drive in Lemon Grove. Parishioners fully restored it after a devastating fire in 1972. It is the oldest continuously operated Episcopal church in San Diego County. A far different architectural style, Spanish Mission Revival, can be seen at St. John of the Cross Church on Broadway. Built in 1959, this church celebrated its Diamond Jubilee in 2015. The Knights of Columbus Hall, built in 1940, was the original St. John of the Cross Church and is still used today as a church hall. You can learn more and see historical photographs of these fascinating sites at the Lemon Grove Historical Society's website at lghistorical.org.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Alexa Oslowski with a Crime Beat report. Two people are under arrest after yet another illegal marijuana dispensary was shut down by sheriff's deputies on Grand Avenue in Spring Valley. Most troubling items seized include counterfeit candy and chips containing marijuana, with fake labels resembling major brand names such as Skittles, Fritos, Ruffles, and Doritos. According to the Sheriff's Department, it is not uncommon for illegal dispensaries to sell such THC-infused products marketed to children, creating potential health risks for youngsters. The raid conducted the morning of April 30th by the Sheriff's Narcotics and Gang Division also found 74 pounds of marijuana, 170 pounds of THC vape products, 195 pounds of cannabis-infused edibles, 135 pounds of THC concentrates, over $12,000 in cash, and one firearm. Sheriff's detectives were accompanied by San Diego County's code compliance team, which found several violations in the building that created a danger to its occupants. As a result, code compliance asked SDG&E to cut off power to the entire property until the dangers could be mitigated. The warrant and raid at the Spring Valley dispensary follows community concerns about illegal marijuana outlets operating near schools and homes. Unlike legal cannabis dispensaries, which are strictly regulated, Illegal, unregulated facilities have been catalysts for violence and property crimes affecting nearby residents and businesses. Spring Valley has been the scene of numerous robberies and several fatality shootings at illegal dispensaries, unlike neighboring La Mesa, which legalized cannabis sales and imposed strict regulations, which helped push illegal operators out of town.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Consumer and business groups are speaking out in favor of California legislation to create an agency dedicated to cutting health care costs. AB 1130 from Assemblymember Jim Wood would establish a state office of health care affordability. The agency would have the power to set cost targets for health plans, hospitals, and more, and to enforce them. Bill Barcelona with America's Physician Groups says experts are needed to ferret out where, how, and why the marketplace is failing patients.
You have to have someone at the top of the system looking at the data, finding the gaps, and driving innovation, and on the negative side, driving compliance.
Opponents object to what they see as more government intervention in the healthcare marketplace. According to the California Healthcare Foundation, costs for California families who get healthcare through their jobs have jumped 142% in recent years, far outpacing the growth of median household income. Rhonda Smith with California Black Health Network says the U.S. healthcare system is broken.
We spend the most on healthcare costs, and we have the worst outcomes. We spend more on hospitalization than any other developed nation. And we have the worst life expectancy at birth than any other developed nation.
The new agency would look at moving to a new system of payments that rewards providers when they improve patient outcomes instead of the current fee-for-service model that encourages volume. Anthony Wright with the nonprofit advocacy group Health Access says the current system sets costs primarily based on the potential for profit rather than effectiveness or equity.
The price is not necessarily based on the best quality or outcomes, but is based on what the market can bear.
The bill is in the Appropriations Committee. Its backers are asking for $11.2 million to fund the agency for the first year. They say they're optimistic that Governor Gavin Newsom will include the funding in his budget update due in a week. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A fast-moving brush fire that started on May 1st scorched about 5,200 acres and burned at least three structures. The southern fire started in Mason Valley near Butterfield Ranch in San Diego's East County and prompted over 500 people to evacuate. Gusty winds and heavy smoke limited firefighting aircraft's ability to battle the blaze initially, prompting an air quality warning from the county and shutdown of State Route 2, the Great Overland Stage Route. By May 3rd, all evacuation orders and warnings were lifted. Eduardo and Priscilla Valenzuela lost their family's ranch home, narrowly escaping with their children, ages 10, 5, and 2 years old. The fire moved so quickly that the family of 5 could only salvage one bag of belongings before firefighters escorted them to safety and lost everything else except their horses that were set free and some barn cats that also survived. A GoFundMe site has been set up to help the Valenzuela family. Javier Flores, who set up the fundraiser, says we're glad they made it safely out, but now would like to ask for help from the community and friends to restore their peace of mind, adding, "Thank you and God bless our firefighters." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery. Next up, we have some national news headlines from Public News Service's 2021 Talk.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
You know, I know the times have been tough here. The damage of the hurricanes has been devastating.
President Joe Biden visited Lake Charles, Louisiana, and toured areas still recovering from two hurricanes last year. Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, along with Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley, have asked the White House to provide more disaster assistance after recent hurricanes, floods, and winter weather. Biden also said the administration is pivoting from COVID-19 to his Rebuilding America infrastructure plan.
Rebuilding in a way that it has resilience. And the folks who are going to rebuild it, those folks right over there, unions, are going to rebuild it in a way that we're going to provide good jobs.
In Rhode Island, Vice President Kamala Harris described the results of getting people vaccinated.
You can see around the country how that is having an impact on businesses reopening, on getting back to some semblance of what we remember as normalcy.
A study from the University of Washington says we've badly underestimated the number of people killed by the pandemic. They say COVID-19 may have killed as many as 900,000 Americans. In Washington, D.C., Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Joint Chiefs Chair Mark Milley discussed the planned withdrawal from Afghanistan and a new independent review commission on sexual assault in the military. Milley said he is confident they can meet the president's time frame for removing U.S. troops.
As you know, we've been transferring steadily functions and responsibilities to the Afghan security forces for a considerable amount of time. The President of the United States has given us a window to be complete no later than September.
Austin also talked about their efforts to address domestic terrorist ideology within the military.
Clearly, we have a lot of work to do, and I want to be blunt. There is no place for hatred or bigotry or extremist behavior in this department or in the military.
Meanwhile, states are bracing for redistricting battles as they await the results of the 2020 census. Michelle Davis with Legislative Services for the Maryland General Assembly says the data has been slow coming.
And the delay in the redistricting data comes from a couple of things. Most of it is COVID. This is going to be about a 4-month delay.
Full census data is expected to be delivered to states by September 30th. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson has signed a law strengthening privacy for people who donate to charities. Jarek Adams with the website Ballotpedia says it could allow nonprofits involved in politics to funnel so-called dark money into campaigns anonymously.
If you donate to a nonprofit that is heavily involved in politics and your donations to that nonprofit are not disclosed, you have sort of disproportionate influence without any of the accompanying accountability that comes with making a donation to a candidate.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan. Thanks for listening.
This is Alexa Oslowski with a health report. Getting a COVID-19 vaccine in San Diego County just became easier. All county-run COVID-19 vaccination sites are now open for walk-ups with no appointments required. Here in East County, those locations include the East Public Health Center in El Cajon, the Lemon Grove Community Center, the Tubman Chavez Community Center on Euclid, and Viejas Arena's Parking Lot 13 at San Diego State University. Hours vary by location, and the number of vaccines may be limited at some spaces. You can find a full list of county-run vaccination sites in East County Magazine's health section or at the County News Service website. Local health officials also announced this week that the county has resumed use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccines, which were temporarily paused by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in order to study adverse reactions in a small number of recipients. The FDA has concluded that the benefits of the single-dose vaccine outweigh its risks and approved it for emergency use. The California Department of Public Health over the weekend also approved the vaccine's usage. The county's Health and Human Services Agency cautions, however, that women under the age of 50 should be aware of the rare but increased risk of blood clots after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. If you have concerns, please talk to your doctor. The other two vaccines available locally, made by Pfizer and Moderna, have not been linked to any blood clot issues. The county has about 12,000 doses of the J&J vaccine available and will offer them at mobile vaccination sites and walk-up vaccine pods. The one-dose vaccine will also be used for homebound individuals and agricultural workers who are often more difficult to reach for the second dose. COVID-19 vaccines are available at no cost to anyone 16 and older who lives or works in San Diego County. Minors aged 16 or 17 need parental consent to make an appointment or must be accompanied by the parent or guardian to get vaccinated at a no-appointment site. In addition to the new walk-in options, the county will also continue to offer vaccination appointments that can be scheduled online. To make an appointment, go to vaccinationsuperstationsd.com.
The County of San Diego has also opened up 3 evening vaccination clinics to make it easier to get COVID-19 vaccines. The 3 clinics are administering Pfizer and Moderna vaccines to people with and without appointments. People are welcome to drop in, whether for a first dose or second dose that is a follow-up to one received elsewhere. The sites will be offering doses from 1 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the East Public Health Center in El Cajon, as well as the North Coast LiveWell Health Center in Oceanside and the South Region LiveWell Health Center in Chula Vista. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health official, says with 1.5 million San Diegans now having received at least one dose of the vaccine, and with vaccination sites more widespread, we are able to improve convenience. By offering evening hours, the county is providing the public even more options to help us get to herd immunity and back to the things we love, Dr. Wooten concludes. Anyone 16 and up who lives, works, or goes to school in San Diego County can now receive a COVID-19 vaccine at no cost. And you can find more locations at coronavirus-sd.com/vaccine. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Lions, Tigers, and Bears in Alpine, San Diego's only accredited big cat and bear sanctuary, has rescued three exotic cats, the last animals left at a facility in Southern California that will close down at the end of the month. The new residents are Lily, a female white tiger, Eli, a male African serval, and Savannah, a female African serval. They came from a facility that could no longer care for the animals. Lions, Tigers, and Bears will provide lifetime care for the mature big cats, which arrived on April 27th. All three cats are mature and will require ongoing veterinary care. Lions, Tigers, and Bears is one of the few sanctuaries in the United States with the highest level of accreditation from the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries and the American Sanctuary Association. The exotic animal rescue nonprofit, led by Bobby Brink, has coordinated rescues for more than 600 big cats, bears, wolves, and other exotic animals across the U.S. in need of permanent refuge and lifetime homes at reputable sanctuaries. For more information or to donate to help care for the new arrivals, you can visit lionstigersandbears.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County. Next up, we're going to play one of our Best of East County episodes for you, an interview done a few years ago with author Mike Sirota.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Mike Sirota, author of Freedom's Hand, with Atorus Press, as well as over 20 novels, including ghost stories, horror fiction, adventure fantasy, and swords and sorcery. My guest is also an award-winning feature writer and editor. He's been workshop facilitator, university instructor, and writing coach. Welcome, Mike. It's great to see you again and have you here in the studio.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's begin with your latest novel, Freedom's Hand, which is about a concentration camp established not in Poland, but in the desert of the American Southwest. Tell us about that. It's a fascinating premise. And what prompted you to write about it?
Well, I grew up in New York City back in the 50s, and there were a lot of people there who were kind of different. They were quiet. They were surly. They just didn't talk too much. And once in a while, we noticed they had numbers on their arms. Well, what could that possibly be? No one spoke about the Holocaust then. These were all survivors, and no one talked about it too much. And I grew up in the dark. And when I finally, years later, found out what it was all about, it was powerful. I not only learned who and what these people were, but I also found out that our own family had victims that perished in the Holocaust. And I just felt I had to do something about that. So I waited a while. It took a while to do Freedom's Hand, but that was sort of the foundation for it. And the idea that it might happen again is not inconceivable. So that was the basis for it.
Why the American Southwest? How did that come about?
Well, I live here.
Right.
I live in California. I don't want to give away too much about where the camp is, but I'm pretty familiar with the desert. And I thought, of all places, it's so bleak and barren that if someone did do something as horrific as that, they would put it in a place that would be practically inaccessible to most people. Even for themselves, it's quite difficult getting to where I've located this camp.
Is it just a fictional idea, or do you also believe that this is something that could actually happen in the United States?
Well, I don't know about the United States. I mean, it happened during World War II with Japanese internment and all. But even to this day, these things are happening. They're happening all over the world. They're happening. Look at North Korea.
Right.
North Korea has detention camps, labor camps right now that people are worked to death in. So it's not impossible that this could happen and that people like my fictional commander who runs the camp and who devised this whole thing, there are people like that now, like the guy in North Korea, excuse me.
Sure.
And that's the scariest thing, is that there are still people out there, people that hate so much. On my blog, I remember writing about what I call hate never dies. It's a little parody on Andrew Lloyd Webber's Love Never Dies. I call it Hate Never Dies because that's the truth. There seems to be people like this always, unfortunately.
Right, and it can happen in a beautiful place like the American Southwest.
Why not?
Well, I know that in addition to the accomplishments that I mentioned earlier, you spent 14 years as an award-winning feature writer and editor for a Southern California news magazine. What magazine is that or was that? And how did that kind of work compared to writing fiction?
Yes, past tense. It was the San Diego Jewish Times.
Oh.
I was their editor and feature writer, and they had a good run. They operated between 25 and 30 years, I believe, before they finally closed down, kind of victimized by the fact that everything is online these days and all that. The only way they could publish, of course, was to sell advertising, and the original owners did a great, great job of that. Ultimately, they retired, and the people taking it over couldn't keep up that pace. They lost the advertising revenue, and out they went. But it was a nice run for me. It was a good foundation. You don't get rich writing novels.
No.
So at least I had a paycheck every week and had some health coverage and all of that, and the freedom to do a lot of what I did, which was write and teach and all of that. But the writing was different. You know, we have X column inches, and we have to write 342 words. Maybe you can give one, or take one or two, but that's what we had to do, 342 words. And for a novelist who's written novels of up to 250,000 words, that's kind of limiting.
Right.
But I got used to it. I got used to doing that. And I think it actually helped my writing also, being more succinct in my, fiction writing.
Right. It's a discipline.
Right, right. So it was a good run. I got to meet a lot of interesting people. I think the highlight of my career there was on my 50th birthday, which was a long time ago. I got to interview Elie Wiesel, who was the author of Night, and of course, Holocaust survivor, Nobel Prize winner, one of the first people who actually started bringing the Holocaust to light and had the guts to write about it, about his experiences. Mm-hmm. So I think that was one of the highlights of working there.
It sounds like you've really combined your interest in history with fantasy, and is that correct, and horror and that?
Right, right. Well, I have a great deal of interest in Native Americans, and in three of my four horror novels, if you want to call them that, ghost stories, they are Native American themed, getting into the mythology of the particular tribes, all of which, for some reason, I picked ones in Northern California. And actually, my next novel, which I know you were going to ask me anyway, is a historical novel. It's kind of the work of over maybe 30 years, I think, on and off that I have worked on this novel. And I finally got it to where I wanted it to be, I believe, and I think I'm going to put it out next year. And it is a historical novel on a particular tribe up in Northern California that not many people know about, but they had an amazing story, an amazing history, both with their war with the United States government. And I chose as the main character a woman in the tribe, a real woman, who married a white man. And together they went through all the conflict between these tribes and ultimately served as interpreters during the war.
Wow.
And Just recently, I made contact with her great-great-granddaughter, who is still around.
Really?
And she's pretty much excited about, you know, having me do this and all. It is a novel, but it's, I'd say, 90% true. I put in a few extra characters here and there. We take a little bit of liberty when we write novels, but the story, the bulk of the story, or the heart of the story, is true.
Can you tell us the name of the novel? Or not yet?
Well, I can. It's called Stone Woman.
Okay.
The stone being the lava beds in Northern California, mm-hmm. which is where the war took place. I visited the lava beds years ago. It's one of the most forbidding and really creepy, places you could imagine. And the gist of the war itself was that 50 Braves fought off 1,000 U.S. soldiers for up to 6 months.
Really?
During the war, and lost hardly any of their people in their tribe. Mm-hmm. It was just an amazing, amazing story of courage and everything. And, of course, the typical, the white people got there, took the land, took this, they want to put them somewhere else and all mm-hmm. that. So it's sort of a microcosm of all that happened in Native America across the country.
Well, I could see why you like to write about history.
Right.
Now, what is it about writing horror that appeals to you? I always ask this question.
Well, I've always loved horror. I've always loved to be scared in the movies and all of that, reading books and so on. And I think it's a real challenge to scare people. And I don't like cheap scares. I don't like the cat jumping out of the cupboard when you open it up, or the hand falling out of the closet, some clown playing a trick on their buddy in these teen slasher flicks. I like real horror. I like subtle horror that builds up and up until you kind of feel like something's crawling up your back. Mm. So that's what I try to accomplish, a slow buildup to where I finally hit him in the face with it. In fact, one of the funniest stories about that, I think my most subtle and one of my favorites is a novel I wrote years ago that Bantam Books published called Demon Shadows. And it was subtle. It was and it is republished now. I republished it under my own imprint. And in the last chapter is where everything is supposed to hit the fan. And I built up subtle, 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 subtle. And the last chapter kind of stayed subtle. So Bantam, when they had the whole book, wrote back and said, you need to jack up the horror in the last chapter. Have a ball.
Okay.
So I had a ball. It's really gross. I just reread it. Just let loose. So I built it up, and hopefully that would scare people. But it did take a buildup for that.
Well, it sounds like a fun read. Let's talk for a minute about your history of teaching. I mean, I know you've served as instructor for workshop facilitator for UCSD Extension, the Southern California Writers Conference, La Jolla Writers Conference, and the Alaska Writers Guild Conference. In 2002, you were honored as the first person of letters by the La Jolla Writers Conference for your quote-unquote ongoing and unselfish contributions to and support of the writing community. Can you tell us something about the San Diego writing community? Why do you enjoy working with the writing community? And
well, I enjoy working with writers, period, wherever they come from. You know, when I've met them from people from Australia, I've worked with people in Australia, I've worked with people in the Middle East and all. I just, writers love being around writers. There's a certain energy we have.
Yes.
That, and we understand each other, I think, mm-hmm. more than anyone else. You know, one writer is not going to ask a writer, so you write books. Well, what do you do to make money? Or what's your day job? There's just that, you know, that nobody asks you that, whereas in the real world, it's, oh, so you write books, but what do you do for a living?
Right. What else do you do?
Yeah, exactly. And in most cases, that's true, unfortunately. It's not a road to riches, but we writers understand each other, and I've always loved to be around writers. I can pick out one incident. About 6 years ago, it was a week before the Southern California Writers Conference up in Newport Beach. And my 18-year-old cat passed away on my lap, and I was devastated. My wife was out of the country. I was all alone with, and I had to deal with that. And I said, I don't think I even want to go to the conference this year. You know, I was scheduled to do some workshops and classes and one-on-ones, and I just didn't want to do it. I was so devastated by losing, you know, a beloved pet. And I made myself go up there, and I had such a great time. You know, just being around the energy of writers and everything, I just kind of forgot about it for a couple of days and just enjoyed myself. And that really said something. You know, that really said something,
yes,
what writers are all about.
It does. I know that you've mentored a couple of successful authors here in town. Can you tell us about the mentoring process and how it feels to see those authors doing well?
One of the biggest thrills I have is, you know, first of all, opening up a newly published book and in the acknowledgement seeing somebody thank me.
Yes.
That's happened many times. I've probably had, you know, I know of about 100 novels that writers of mine that I've worked with in the past
wow.
or more have been published. But I love going to their book signings, and I love, you know, seeing the energy around them that they're so excited about it. It was interesting because when I stopped writing for quite a while to do this mentoring and teaching, and I wondered, how would I feel if one of my people is having this great success and I'm not being published anymore? And when the first one called up and said, I'm published, I actually bounced off the walls just as hard as she did.
Right.
I was so excited for her, and it was easy after that. Yeah. So I love seeing other people's successes and working with ones like I just finished the, I don't know, about 20 novels with Michelle Scott,
mm-hmm.
who is a local author. And she was unpublished, unagented when I started working with her back in 2004, 10 years ago. And she's published about 20-odd novels since then. She's doing great. She's one of Amazon's top sellers. She can't put them out fast enough for them. And we're almost like family now. So I'm not working with too many people as much as I used to. But her I'll work with forever and some of my primary people. It is a matter of pride. It really is great to see people succeed and know you had some kind of mm-hmm. role in it.
I hear this a lot from writers about giving back.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we do. That's what we try to do in everything. And, you know, just I wasn't like that in the early days. To me, it was, I'm a writer. You're not.
Right.
I'm published. You're not. And I lost that attitude real quick. It's a very humbling profession. And now I just take joy in seeing others succeed and all of that. And I have fun doing what I do. But, you know, that's it. I just enjoy writing and everything about it.
That's great to hear. Well, Mike, our time is up, but thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
For more information on Mike Sirota, his work and his blog, which is called Swords, Specters, and Stuff, please visit his websites. He's got two of them at www.mikesirota.com and www.swordsandspectors.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.